welcome to the Flying Solo Podcast. I am your host, Katie Kangas, and each week on the show, we will talk about how to take flight and follow your dreams as a solopreneur architect. In this episode, I spoke with Edward J. Shannon, an architect whose journey reflects the traits of a woodpecker. Day after day, he is persistently pecking away at his practice, a solo practice where he connects with clients, and together they build a project with a story that resonates with that client's deeper goals. Ultimately, Ed is leaving a legacy in the homes he designs for current homeowners that'll last future generations. We also talk about his book, The Sole Practitioner Architect, where he outlined 6 types of sole practitioners. Because even though we run our own businesses, and even if that business is just us, it doesn't mean we are practicing alone. And sharing our stories is one way we can connect and collaborate with one another. Ed Shannon, thank you so much for joining the Flying Solo Podcast. I'm so glad to have you with me. Can you tell me a little bit about yourself and your firm?
Sure. I'm a sole practitioner architect. I do mainly residential projects. I'm originally from the Chicago area and started my career there and moved to Des Moines 12 years ago and reestablished my practice here about 8 years ago. Rebranding the practice. It's now called Spirit Lake Studio, and we have a branch office in Spirit Lake as well as the office here in Des Moines, and hoping to build and move to Spirit Lake and practice there exclusively. So,
well, this is an exciting time. You don't often rebrand a practice, especially one that's as established as your own. So what are 3 words that are describing your firm as Spirit Lake Architecture?
Oh, okay. Well, soul, it's just me. You get all of my expertise in every aspect of your project. I would say small. I specialize in small projects and give small projects a lot of attention. I take them very seriously and I thrive on them. I would say, there's that lifestyle aspect to this too, that, I look at the practice as a lifestyle.
I like hearing that. And it's so different than any other firm I've talked with. So soul, small, and lifestyle. Can you describe that further? You wrote a book about this.
I did. During the pandemic, I wrote a book on being a sole practitioner architect, because there really wasn't, to my knowledge, any book written by a sole practitioner about being a sole practitioner. My book was written really to help sole practitioners see their practice as an asset and as a destination. And the AIA, when they do their surveys of firms, not of members, but of firms, about 30% of the firms are one person. So that's a huge, percentage of firms are one person. And when I heard that statistic, when I first, I thought, well, this has to be a legitimate practice model if 30% of the firms practice this way. Yet, I've had colleagues try to, discourage me from it, or, I've had other, people say, are you serious? You want to be a sole practitioner? I mean, I get starting off as a sole practitioner, as a stepping stone to bigger and better things. But, you really want to remain a sole practitioner? And I'm like, yes, at least for now. I mean, things can always change. But I want to, that's how I want to practice. That's sure.
That's sort of the spirit of flying solo. And so, yeah.
it does take a different type of mentality. And your book is The Sole Practitioner Architect, a practice guide for the solopreneur. And I love that term, solopreneur, because there's that entrepreneurial spirit that is built into being a sole practitioner. So how would you describe that spirit, that it's maybe a creative mentality that's brought to the business mindset? Or how do you describe that solopreneur?
I think the entrepreneur part has always been with me, because my dad owned his own business, as did my grandfather. So I always saw myself as being self-employed, you know, I guess, for better or worse, being the boss. And some days that's worse, believe it or not. But and then, you know, the soul part, again, that came first out of necessity. When I first started practicing, and I opened my firm in 1999, in Chicago suburbs, and I had a half-time teaching position. So I had kind of half-time job for 9 months of the year, and then had to supplement my income for the rest. You know, at first it was out of necessity, and I would see myself sometimes as having a disadvantage, because I was just one person. And I didn't have a lot of confidence sometimes when I interviewed, especially if I was up against other architects, other architecture firms, maybe small firms going after the same kind of work that I was going after. And in a book, a practice book, I read, the author said, look at your sole practice as an asset, not as a liability. And, you know, the biggest asset is that you are bringing every part of your expertise to every aspect of the project. And, you know, that and kind of that statistic from the AIA, you know, made me realize, you know, this is a legitimate practice model, and it's got some advantages to it. You know, it's not a liability. It's got some disadvantages too. But if you don't like managing people or are not good at managing people, it's a really nice business model.
I agree, because one thing I talk to sole practitioners about is that they can design their firm around their personal strengths, their hopes, and their dreams, and it can take the form that they need it to take. If you have the discipline, you can work the hours that you want to work and take the time off to fit family or other priorities or teaching or however you want to craft your profession. You can have agency over the shape of what your own firm looks like. And I think that's what you're talking about with that asset. So how do you think your personal strengths and hopes and dreams for how to practice have helped shaped your type of firm? Because in your book, you do describe different types of sole practitioner architects.
Yeah. I think for me, when I started my career, actually kind of the second time I started my career, it was the early 90s, and most of the country was in a recession then, and especially in Chicago. And I really wanted to work for like a boutique firm downtown Chicago. And after a year of looking for a job, I was fortunate enough to get hired by a real nuts and bolts suburban firm doing schools. And I worked on schools for about 6 years. And but in that time, I designed my parents' house, which was a great experience, and it received an award. And I worked for two different school firms. And the second firm, they did have a couple of house projects, and they were kind of, you know, really favors, you know, for friends of the owners. And so I was kind of put on them. And probably after about 6 years, I felt it was time for a change. The economy was in a much better place. And I thought, what do I really want to do? You know, I mean, I think I really want to work, on residential. So I went to work for a firm on the Chicago North Shore, and they not only taught me kind of the nuts and bolts of residential, I was hired as a project architect. They would give me their proposal agreement, their letter agreement, with the fee in it and with their hourly rates, and say, here, you budget this project. Okay, here's the fee. Here's all of our rates, your rate, your drafter, your technician's rates, the principal's rates, figure out, how you're going to do this. It was really a great thing, because the other firms I worked for kept all that stuff locked up in file cabinets. You never knew how much the fee was, which is a terrible thing, really, for a firm. I mean, firms should be transparent. Everyone should kind of understand what the budget of a project is. Anyway, they taught me, I was only at this firm not quite a year because I got the teaching position. But in that time, I cycled through like 5 projects. I learned a great process for schematic design, and a great filing process that I still use. They taught me a lot of tools. And getting back to your question, I found something I liked and I was really good at. And so that's what I want to do. What I enjoy doing and what I'm good at doing. And what I feel I'm good at doing is these residential projects, additions, new homes, whatever they may be. I kind of like to say the only thing I'm really not good at in that realm are like McMansions and large builder houses. I don't think that way. My thinking about architectures a lot different. So, just finding something you're good at, and, that's what I want to do over and over again.
I love that. And then you can hone your skills and advance in your skills as an architect to better serve your clients. Okay. And so how do you find clients who align with that mission of the dream homes?
Well, that's not always easy, especially in Des Moines, Iowa. I get probably my better projects really come from my websites, which if you'd have told me that when I started relaunched my practice 7 or 8 years ago, I'd have said, no, it's all going to be referral based and so forth. But I'm in a market where a lot of people don't know that they can go to an architect. They think that you go to a builder first. And, unfortunately, with programs like Chief Architect and some of these programs has pretty much a lot of the builders have that. And, they really feel they can, do what we do as good as we do it. And maybe to a lot of their clients, they can't tell the difference. I know I'm an architect. I'm not a builder. I don't want to pretend that I could do a builder's job as good as they can. But sometimes I don't see that reciprocated. I see builders who think, I can easily, the design part's easy. So it is trying to find those people who really appreciate your gifts, your strengths, your creativity. And for me, I try to emphasize, that I do very comprehensive drawings, and that's to their benefit. And, money spent up front in design fees is pennies on the dollar compared to, what you're spending in construction. And, flawed homes cost a ton of money to build too. They're not cheaper, so homes that don't flow well, homes, especially additions that look like the tail is wagging the dog, those things cost just as much to build. you know, superficially, we do look like we're more expensive, you know, than, you know, especially when a builder says, we have in-house design. You know, I've had to remind people that, you know, that's not free. I mean, if they're paying someone to do that, that's all coming out of your construction costs. And we even have lumber yards here who do, free plan services. And I mean, my dad owned a lumber yard, and my grandfather, their job was selling lumber. You know, that's what they do. And so if they're offering you, you know, some kind of complimentary drafting service, it's a sales tool to get you to buy $200,000 worth of materials from them. It's not what they're in business to do. So I've had to have that conversation, you know, with people. I had, as a matter of fact, one of my most recent successful projects, the owner kind of, you know, I don't know if it was after he had signed the agreement or during when we were interviewing, said, you know, can you just do the beginning part of the project? Because I know the guys at the lumberyard and they can, you know, kind of take it from there. And I said, you know, I said that same thing. I said, look, my dad owned a lumberyard. They're not in business to provide really excellent, you know, drawings. And you have come to me because you don't want the cookie cutter builder house. And that's what they can draw you. But we're going to have some really, you know, wonderful details. And, you know, and it all has to come together. And they did agree to that, and they did pay, you know, a full fee, and the house is beautiful. I think even the builder and the guy from the lumberyard, the guy from the lumberyard actually just wrote me an unsolicited review on Facebook, on my Facebook page. Very brief, just said Ed has some great ideas, you know, but I was like, wow, okay. So we have to, you know, we have to educate our clients. I mean, these are first time people who've never hired an architect before, and a lot of them never will. So we have to communicate what our value is, and it's, you know, hopefully they can see it in our portfolio. If they can't see it, they're probably not going to knock on our door anyways. But, you know, beyond that, it's kind of these comprehensive services that we do that we'll get them some really excellent, you know, details. We'll get them, you know, really comprehensive construction drawings, which saves them money in construction. And if they are bidding projects, which isn't done that much here, but I mean, you know, you need that good, you know, a vague set of drawings is going to get you vague pricing. I mean, that's all there is to it. So I have to continuously sell like the whole package.
I think it's coming out in who you're working with, that you're working with these one-time homeowners, and your Spirit Lake Studio website talks about the story of the person who's reaching out to you and trying to tell their story in the design project. And you're making a harder sell than just an architect who's known for a certain type of architecture or a certain type of design, and people are like perusing the looks and choose that architect because of the look. That's a different marketing strategy to just be known for that. Whereas you're trying to communicate that value, which is almost, it's that you live in a home that's comfortable, and how you explain like the light switch is exactly where you need it to be. The steps from here to here, your kitchen fits you. It fits how you live, instead of living in a house that's too big or too small, or things just feel a little bit off. And it's the challenging conversation. And I think you're doing a good job, especially with the resources that you provide on your website, because then it seems like if you're getting clients through your website, it's people who are self-motivated to inform themselves about their options. And so you're providing what they're looking for, and they're almost warm leads by the time they reach out to you, because they feel like they've started to know your vision for how a project is run and understand your process based on what you're already putting out for them to read. Mm-hmm. And so mm-hmm. I don't know if it's those that are more helpful or if it's your portfolio and them seeing actual projects that's more helpful for them to choose you if it's not a style that you're selling.
Yeah, I think it's kind of both. I don't know. I you know, when I talked about earlier, I was telling you about this residential firm I went to work for on the North Shore of Chicago, and I showed them I showed them my parents' house, which, you know, modern house, post and beam construction, summer house on Lake Michigan, up in northern Wisconsin, with a big wall of glass and all this. And they were, you know, real impressed. And they showed me like a modern home that they had done. And, you know, I started working there. And like the first week they had me just kind of doing some red lines and things like that. And then they said, okay, we're going to give you your first project. Here it is. It's a Georgian house. And I was aghast. I mean, I was just like, are you kidding me? What did I sign up for here? And,
oh, wow.
I mean, I cringed, I think, the first week or two, you know, working on this. And all of a sudden, there's a couple things that happened. First of all, I was, you know, kind of working in three dimensions, which is how I love to work. I love to work in section and all that. And this Georgian house had to have an attic and a stair that kind of went up there. And they had on the North Shore, they have some real strict FAR requirements. So it all had to fit this envelope. And so, I was doing all this, and all of a sudden I started liking it. And then I started thinking, well, I want to learn more about Georgian architecture. And I went out and, you know, bought an old pattern book, you know, and all of a sudden I started wanting to learn about a little more about stylistic architecture. And, you know, this was in 1998, 1999. I mean, you pretty much had to do traditional styles if you wanted to be a residential architect in especially in the Chicago suburbs. I mean, there just wasn't a market for, you know, a lot of modern architecture. And consequently, I would have people, you know, after I began my practice, I remember someone called me, and it was a friend of my sister's. And I didn't really know him, but he said, you know, I visited your parents' house. I love that. And we want to do this addition to our, you know, we've got this Cape Cod and, you know, one of the suburbs in Chicago, but we love all the, you know, the angles and all that. And so, you know, and so back then I would do like three schemes. I had this, that firm taught me this great freehand sketch technique, and I would do three schemes, and I was teaching at the same time too. And I had kind of a, you know, very traditional scheme, kind of a hybrid scheme, you know, a little more contemporary, and then one that had, you know, kind of this abstract Cape Cod roof with a undulating wall of glass under it, all that. So, of course, the client right away, even though he loved all the moderns, picked the real traditional scheme. I mean, that was it. And I remember showing it to my students, showing them the three schemes, and they all loved the modern scheme. They all were like, this is the one, this is the one. And I said, well, guess what? We met last night, and they picked the traditional one. And they're like, what? I'm like, yeah, you need to realize, and this is the, you know, to the students, you know, you need to realize not everyone likes modern design like we do, you know, or they might say they like it, but they don't really want to live in it. You know, they, you know, I mean, that's what I found too, is a lot of people would say, well, I love that, but, you know, when it comes to my house, I mean, no, I don't want to live in that, you know, but I love the house you did, you know, for your parents, and time and again, I would, you know, see that. So, you know, I had to learn, you know, and I call it becoming a born again stylist. I mean, I had to, you know, I had to, you know, kind of become that. And so my portfolio is very style neutral. I hope, you know, my work stands out, but a lot of times it's very subtle, especially the traditional projects. So there is that, you know, there is that process. And if I could say one more, you know, my kind of ethos is what I call story-formed design. And that means that every project has a story. And the, you know, it has a storyline. And everything relates back to that story. In architecture school, we'd call that a concept. You know, it's kind of like, what's your concept? But, you know, to my clients, it's a story. And I can talk to them because they don't know about the design process. And the first thing they think you do is that you just start drawing and you just, you crank out a scheme, you know. And I say, you know, and I relate it to, I'll say, you know, even a good author, really good author who's written 30 books, they don't crank out a draft. They don't, you know, they don't do the first draft. And, you know, they have a story, a storyline, but they're trying to craft this book. And they might write the beginning and they might write the end, and they'll work on that. And then they'll go and kind of work on the middle of the story. And then they'll realize that now they got to kind of revise part of the ending or part, you know. And I said, that's typical in the design process. We do not, unlike construction, with construction, you know, dig a hole, pour a foundation, put a floor deck on, put walls up, put a roof, you know, frame. Very lineal process. We don't have a real lineal process. I mean, our process, it's not that, you know, sequential. And a lot of our client, you know, we have to help explain that to our clients. So I use the analogy of you know, a book, an author writing a book. I use that a lot. And then, you know, the analogy of the story, you know.
I would love to talk with you about your different SPA types, your sole practitioner architect types. And you give 6 in your book. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious how you would define, if you could just give a quick summary of each.
Okay.
Well, there's the urban studio. How would you describe the urban studio sole practitioner?
So let me think who that was. That Kenneth, I think. The urban, you know, in that case, he's, you know, working in a very urban setting and doing, you know, a little bit more urban projects, probably, you know, tied into the, you know, into the community, has some community involvement.
Yeah. So I would think of that as a Heron, who is someone who knows their community and integrates. But it reminds mm-hmm. me of when I collaborate on urban projects with other sole practitioners, and we mm-hmm. just kind of like come together when it makes sense and when we need the skills of one another. And then we still have our own practices, but there's times that we benefit from collaborating to kind of compete on the bigger firms by working together. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of that urban studio idea. I like it. What about the rural architect? And that was Robert Swinburg.
Oh, yeah, yeah. He's a really wonderful practice in Vermont. And, you know, obviously he's doing a lot of residential. Maybe he's, you know, doing some small commercial projects too. You know, generally, you know, they're going to be kind of country houses, you know, in the woods or you know, maybe in town. But his, you know, his portfolio is a lot of houses, you know, in, you know, kind of beautiful rural or woodsy settings. I know in his practice, he has a lot of, you know, sustainability strategies that, you know, he uses on those projects too.
It says his influence, actually some big names, Frank Lloyd Wright, David Samala, Peter Zumthor, and those are architects with a very specific style that comes through. And that seems like someone who's more known for their colors, like a peacock can be known for its style, and people come to them for that. If if you're willing to broaden your region, I know David Samala serves a large region, to be able to do the specific type of architecture that he loves to do in the way he likes to do it. And so he serves a broad region, and people come to him for his style. So then next is a vernacular regionalist. So Deer Creek Studio, Nori.
Yeah, she's up in Northern California and doing that woodsy California vernacular. You know, when I use the word vernacular, and I think of like kind of a folk style, and I think of vernacular architecture is that, you know, we have it in the Midwest. It's the farmhouses, which, you know, a lot of times didn't have an architect per se. There were just customs and traditional ways of building. They might have had some pattern books or plan books. I mean, they didn't just start building without some kind of plan. But there was this kind of, the word's vernacular. It's kind of passed down from generation to generation. So here's an architect, you know, with that kind of in their midst, and yet not necessarily doing those buildings verbatim, but kind of taking their cues from that. I have a great love for those traditional old houses, but I sure don't want those kitchens, and, you know, a lot of them didn't have bathrooms. I mean, you know, I sure want the amenities of a new house. And so, you know, she was kind of working with that vernacular, influencing her designs, but also, you know, definitely architecture of today.
I've loved vernacular. I love how people solve their own problems, and I like some of the messiness that comes out of it. I find it kind of like that folly. It's interesting to see how these farmhouses, some of them just become sprawling as they get added to in a sensible way. And so I find it very quaint, and I like that folksy.
You said the word. I was going to say, there's a book I have called Common Sense Architecture, and it's all about vernacular and why they built, and everything made sense. I mean, it was not a stylistic, you know, it was just, this is the way we have pitched roofs because it rains and snows here. It's not that we want to do this style. It's not that we want to impress our friends. It's just kind of, this is the common sense way to build, you know, and that's, you know, that's kind of what vernacular comes out of. It's that common sense, you know, kind of design, if you will. Yeah.
It kind of reminds me of a pheasant, a little fancier than a turkey, but like you just kind of pick up the projects that are lying around. You just kind of pick them up. They're little things. You do them all day long. But there's a little extra beauty to it that you take what makes sense and you make that into architecture. You give it that little extra, and it's small things. It's the small moves that just tweak it to be that quaint, that added quaintness of the folksy architecture. How would you describe the hometown architect? And that would be Lee Calliste.
Oh. So, yes, here's a guy who really neat, does really innovative work, but he's in a town outside of Pittsburgh, I think it is. And it's not quite a suburb. I think it's actually, you know, kind of literally outside the suburbs, and he was from there, or, you know, and he came back home, and he's doing, I don't like to use the word modern, I call it neo-modern, but, you know, he's using the neo-modern, you know, kind of work, and he's doing projects in town, and they're, you know, very well detailed, very, very nice scale, very nice massing, but they're definitely modern, or neo, you know, neo-modern. And they fit in, you know, and so it's really amazing. I've been amazed with his work, because he's, you know, I would tend to look at it. If I saw his portfolio, I'd think, well, he's in a major city, and he's actually in this, you know, kind of smaller city outside of a big city, but, you know, doing a lot of work there. Yeah, though I don't.
I may venture to call him a cardinal. If he's got a little boldness, but also they're very habitual in where they live, and they mate and they settle in. But those songbirds, they get their work because the word spreads. One neighbor tells another neighbor they've got a cardinal, and that other neighbor wants it too. And so all of these songbirds, just like the word, the referral network is really strong. And I think that's what you really get when you get to practice in your hometown, But of all the songbirds, I think a cardinal has a very nice look to it. It's pretty iconic.
Sure. Yeah.
Very cool. And then the conductor of the virtual office. And that is, Jennifer. Jennifer Kreshimer.
Yeah. Yep. Well, you know, Jennifer amazed me because she is a soul practitioner, yet she has a network of contract people, I guess I'd call them, that do parts of her projects, and she's very organized. And so, you know, she is managing people, you know, as a soul practitioner. And I wanted to point out, I think, that, you know, there are kind of other models of this, you know, of this practice. It's not just me. It's not just how I practice, but there are other ways of doing it. And that's a real example of someone who's chosen, for whatever reasons, not to have a staffed office, but to rely on outside staff to do a lot of work. And she's got some great systems in place and very dedicated people who want to work for her.
That's great. That's breaking the bird model, because it becomes more of a flock and not just a solo bird. So I think I'm going to have to interview her specifically to find out how she gets work.
Oh, yeah.
All right. Yeah. And then the last one is the incubator of solopreneurs. And you said Peter McCrae.
Mm-hmm. So his practice does, you know, commercial projects, bigger projects, definitely projects that one person would not be able to do, you know, effectively. And if I recall his story, had a firm, and then maybe during the recession, work dropped off, and he, you know, everyone scaled back, and he got, you know, got rid of his office and his overhead, and had a lot of contacts. And one thing he stressed was, you know, he hires, you know, different people to do different parts of projects, and they all work on what they're good at. You know, he's got a nice portfolio and nice work, and you know, under the, you know, kind of the guise of a firm, but, you know, working out of a home office, which, you know, when I was writing that book, which is now almost 5 years ago, during the pandemic, there wasn't as much kind of remoteness as there is now. Peter and Jennifer were, you know, pretty unique in that they kind of had these models where, you know, they don't pay for an office someplace. They have their own home office, and they're hiring people and doing a lot of virtual meetings. And of course that's become, you know, more common now, but I think they were kind of pioneering that. And it was really a kind of a unique business model when they were starting off doing that.
Mm-hmm. The person you described almost reminds me of a crow, because a crow can solve problems. They're so smart. They get right in there. And so you're very specialized, and you get someone else involved when you need to. And so you can collaborate when you need to. Otherwise, you know what you're good at and you dive in. Well, that was really fun. Thank you for letting me riff on your soul practitioner types. This is very interesting to think about them in these different structures, because it may shape so many things. Where people have chosen to live, where they've chosen to work, and how they've chosen to practice has really influenced the firms that you studied and shaped the type of architecture that they do. And so it does really feel like this lifestyle that you're trying to adopt as you're building your own firm.
Right, right.
Do you have any advice to those who might want to consider becoming a soul practitioner? What should they consider?
Well, I'm sure I wrote it down in the book. First thing, I talk about charting your own course. and my advice is, when you're in your 20s, that's a time to explore, you know, work for a big firm, work for a large firm, you know, if you can, so that when you're in your 30s, you can focus. And then when you're in your 40s, basically you can kind of flourish in that. You are really working for you all the time, really, because in this profession, I mean, there's just no one's really looking out for you. I one time heard someone say, you know, you got to get 3 projects to start a firm. You know, you got to have, that's great advice, I think. I never had that. I was always kind of thrown into it one way or another. You know, having 6 months of income put away, great advice. I never had that. But having a household budget is kind of, to me, where it all starts. And do it, you know, and consistently understand where the money you are making and assigning every dollar a place to go, kind of the Dave Ramsey thing. When you start, you will know kind of, okay, how much do I have to make here? And, you know, you can kind of come up with a business plan that's based on, you know, what does my take home need to be as, you know, as a practitioner. So I've got, you know, my take home versus my overhead that I have to account for versus, you know, and taxes. And then I've got, you know, kind of my gross income. And it saddens me that kind of some of the more common questions that are asked in the sole practitioner Facebook is kind of, how much should I charge? How much should I be making? Go back to your own household, you know, your budget, know how much, you know what you need to make versus what you'd really like to make, and know, you know, kind of the minimum that you need to make to kind of crack the nut. And it doesn't really matter what everyone else is making or what you think you should be making. You need to know what you need to make. So, you know, that's really my advice to anyone, is just to have a really firm grounding. It's pretty simple. That's one of the nice things about it. I mean, it's simple accounting. And, you know, I have a real understanding of, you know, what I need to make. And then if I have a slow month or two, and that's happened, you know, I could talk to my wife and we could tighten the belt. You know, we can look at, okay, what do we need to cut out of our expenses at home?
I love that you've put it all in this book as well, The Sole Practitioner Architect, A Practice Guide for the Solopreneur by Edward Shannon. And I think that really sums it up really nicely. I just think we have so much opportunity to grow. I just Googled it, and it's only around 1-2% of buildings in America are designed by architects. And that is terrible. There is so much of a gap in what architects could be doing to help share. It's homes, it's commercial buildings, it's all these things that we can be infiltrating if we are all reaching out and practicing in these ways and filling these gaps. I think it's a role that we can really fill.
Yeah, certainly. Certainly.
Well, great. Thank you so much. This has been a terrific conversation, and it's going to be hard to edit anything out of this because it's been really good to talk through practice and specifically sole practitioner practice. So thank you, Edward. I really appreciate your time.
Sure. Well, we're there to help, and our community is available too. I mean, the Sole Practitioner Architects Facebook is, we try to take issues specific to sole practitioners, but people ask all kinds of questions there too. But we're there to help. And of course, you know, a lot of us have met each other through Mark's LePage's great, you know, efforts with the Entree Architect and so forth. So you're not alone. That's the good thing. You're practicing. There's a lot of other people out there, nice communities.
That's so true. So solo, but not alone. You can all be doing your own thing, but we have so many resources and we help each other. And it's a really great community at Entree Architect, especially.
In this final episode of season 1, it was great to talk with Ed Shannon about his 6 classifications of solo architects. we both see a value in further defining what it means to run a solo architecture firm. There isn't just one formula for professional practice. Success as a sole practitioner is how you define it. I really appreciate how Ed talks about practice holistically. Topics like project planning and finance impact life beyond your 9-to-5. Running your own business can define your lifestyle. And I would take that further and challenge, if you're a current or future sole practitioner, to build your practice around yourself. Sometimes that means we need to grow or change to fit the mold, but it is possible to set goals and structure your practice around the life you want to live. Sure, it takes discipline and honest reflection, but it can be very rewarding. We only talked briefly about Ed's own practice. He is undergoing a brand transformation to become Spirit Lake Studio, a departure from Edward Shannon Architecture. I believe Ed originally founded his firm as a woodpecker, and let me explain how being a woodpecker got him so far in his career. First, Ed is persistent. He has no reservations about picking up the phone or checking in with potential clients. He loves interacting with people, and his residential practice thrives on building connections with his clients. Throughout his career, he worked hard wherever he was, taking each opportunity and giving it his all. Like the work ethic of a woodpecker, day after day, perching and pecking away, either searching for bugs in the bark or finding potential hollows for a home. A woodpecker keeps tapping at a tree. It's actively listening for our second point, resonance. To a woodpecker, that resonance may mean attracting a mate or identifying a porous section of wood full of bug holes. A woodpecker will check the same trees day after day until finding them ready. Similarly, Ed is looking for resonance with his clients to build a storyline that reflects their personal goals. One of Ed's strongest insights is the role of storytelling in architecture. Every project, no matter how modest, has a story. And it's our responsibility as architects to help clients see that story reflected in the built environment. Storytelling creates connection, resonance, and cohesion. It helps clients feel like the project truly belongs to them. When you find resonance with the core story of a project, that tone echoes through every detail. It's in the layout of the plan, the style of the woodwork, the structure, and the exterior aesthetics. It's even in the words the client uses to describe their experience of their process. It leaves a lasting impression, and clients end up repeating that story to friends and family, neighbors, and visitors to their home. Those client stories aren't the only legacy from Ed's practice. And legacy is our final takeaway. Ed Shannon wrote The Sole Practitioner Architect. In this book, he shares the stories of different architects from across the country. The business models he shares are much like the hollows left behind by woodpeckers, openings in trees where other birds may nest. Birds that need to follow because their beak is not quite as sharp or powerful as the woodpecker. The six practice models Ed outlines are like finding an opening in which you can fill with your own architectural practice. You still make the business your own, but at least you're jumpstarting your process by following a path carved by someone else. And really, that is what the Flying Solo podcast is all about. We're sharing stories of very different architects who have developed very different business models. Some may resonate with your own personal strengths or even align with your dreams of running a solo practice. Others may not. But we need to share these stories because even as sole practitioners, we are never truly practicing alone. There is a rich ecosystem of businesses out there and other architects willing to connect and encourage each other. So if you have a vision for your professional practice, I encourage you to take the leap. Take flight and find out where the wind currents take you. This episode was brought to you in collaboration with Entree Architect, which is a fantastic community for finding like-minded entrepreneurs who are there to support you in your business journey. Please subscribe, share, and join the Flying Solo Movement community. We are just taking flight. Please join this journey for ongoing inspiration, support, and resources. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Katie Kangas. My hope is to encourage aspiring entrepreneurs and architects to soar to new heights and embrace the freedom of flying solo.